stay tuned for the Independent News Hour coming up here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. It is now 5 p.m.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Independent News Hour. I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's lefty newspaper and website. We're online at independent.org, independent.org. My co-host Amma Gagarian is out today. So we have another amazing show in the works. In the first half of the show, we're going to hear about some very exciting developments in a long-running union struggle here in New York City between retired city workers and one of the most powerful unions in the city, the UFT. The retirees chapter at the UFT had elections, and the results came in a couple of days ago, and they've shocked many people in the UFT, which is the largest union local in the city. And so there's a lot of ramifications from that that we're going to talk about with someone who's right in the thick of that fight. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to hear from a UAW union organizer, Claire Valdez, who is running for a state assembly seat in Western Queens. She's running as a Democratic Socialist, and she's going to talk about her union background and her vision for what a better city and state could look like. And so we're going to be talking a lot of union stuff over the next hour. But before we get rolling, I do want to remind everyone that WBAI continues to be in a financial emergency. The station is several months behind on rent at Four Times Square, that midtown skyscraper that houses our transmitter and antenna. Now, you could help out right now by calling 212-209-2950 or going to give number two, WBAI.org. If you want to wait a little while, I understand. We've got a really good show we're going to get rolling with here, and I'll share that information with you again over the course of the hour. But we really do need you, the listener, to help out. WBAI has been broadcasting for 64 years right here in the middle of the FM dial because listeners like you always stepped up when we had these moments of financial urgency. We'll return to that later in the hour, but we're going to start out by talking about exciting and interesting developments at the United Federation of Teachers. The union leadership there has been aggressively pushing for the last several years to switch its many tens of thousands of retirees onto a different privately managed healthcare plan that would be run by the Aetna Insurance Corporation. That has provoked outrage not only among UFT retirees, but retirees at other municipal unions that are also in on this bargain, if you will, that the Adams administration and before it the de Blasio administration have been pushing on the unions. The rank and file are pushing back. They've won several court victories. And on Sunday, the results came in from the elections at the UFT retirees chapter, and about 17,000 people voted for an opposition group called Retirees Advocate, and about 10,000 voted for the incumbent. So there's been a big transition there, and we're going to hear more about why this is an important development from Arthur Goldstein. He's the newly elected vice chair of that UFT retirees chapter. He taught ESL at Francis Lewis High School in Queens for more than 30 years. And Arthur, we want to welcome you to WBAI.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. It's great to have you here. So some of this is a little bit complicated, so we want to just kind of walk through it a little bit. So, yes, winning that retirees chapter vote is a big thing, but let's also just talk about the kind of the source of the uproar within the union, that this plan the city has to switch 250,000 retired workers from supplemental Medicare coverage to a private Medicare Advantage plan. Why is that so unpopular to retirees like yourself?
Well, everybody knows that if you're in a Medicare Advantage plan, there are pre-authorizations you need that you don't need in, I'm going to call it real Medicare. We've been pretty outraged about that. I know Michael Mulgrew and his BFFs in the Municipal Labor Committee.
Michael Mulgrew being the president of the teachers union.
Yes, yeah, sorry. They made an agreement to hold off on some of these pre-authorizations, but it's a temporary agreement. And those of us who've been in the city healthcare system, we know how agreements move. We know that co-pays only go up, and we know that things only get more difficult, and we are determined to remain in the Medicare that we've been promised all our careers. And many courts have agreed with us. This is a movement not only by us, but among many city retirees. We know this is not good for us. You know, Diane Ravitch wrote in a comment in one of the columns that she featured that I had written that she had heart surgery. And had she been in an Advantage plan, it would have been denied because, and, you know, we would have no Diane Ravitch. I mean, aside from the personal tragedy in her family, Diane Ravitch is one of the great education thinkers and writers of our generation. And, you know, it's not just Diane Ravitch. It could be you, me. It could be anybody.
You want to talk about your own experience as a cancer survivor? Or this must...
Well,
on you.
I had GHI when I had cancer. I didn't realize I had told you that. But I had GHI when I had cancer. That was about 15, 17 years ago. And, you know, GHI was pretty good to me. The pre-authorizations, they did respond favorably to my doctors at that time. But I do remember days when I'd get bills for thousands of dollars, and I was so weak that I could not muster the energy to argue. And I remember writing checks, paying things I probably shouldn't have paid, that in a Medicare system, you know, that wouldn't happen. Cancer is just, I would not wish it on my worst enemy. And, being sick, I had an 11-year-old kid at the time. It was really a traumatic experience. And, you know, my doctors were good, and thank God I'm here to talk about it. But I don't want people to be lacking something. You know, the original plan was for people to pay if they wanted to remain in real Medicare. And that would be about $200 a month per member, $400 per couple. So for my wife and I, it would be $5,000 a year, you know, to start before they raised it. I might be able to swing that on a teacher's retirement, but teachers make more money than most city workers. We make more money than DC 37 workers. We make more money than UFT paraprofessionals. And I worked 39 years, so I make more money than a lot of retired teachers. To impose a fee like that is so vastly inequitable, vastly unfair to say, well, if you have the money to pay for it, we can get you real care. That's not union. I mean, I've got an idea of what union is. I don't know whether Michael Mulgrew does or not, but I see little evidence that he does. You can't do that to people. Not only that, but Mulgrew, when they wanted to change 12-126, to relieve the mayor from having to pay a minimum toward our health care, actually sent people, former UFT vice presidents and a cancer survivor and somebody, saying, oh, they needed choice. They needed the real Medicare. They needed the right to pay more for it, was what they was really what they were really saying. We can't treat people like that. Everybody needs to have health care, no matter what their salary was, no matter what they can afford, whether it's me, you, or a paraprofessional retiring on a much lower retirement income than I have, for example.
Right. And let's talk about how this came about, because this these extra health care costs they're trying to dump on the retirees are intended to pay for the raises that active members have received in collective bargaining agreements. So you have a situation where union leaders are trying to sort of rob Peter to pay Paul, and the retirees are the ones that are supposed to take the brunt of this.
That's really interesting, because I was at the RTC meeting, and Randy Weingarten spoke extensively about not pitting retirees against in-service members, and yet that is precisely what this did. It pits us against in-service members. It pays for a raise for in-service members that was around cost of living. I mean, to me, the notion that you need to pay for a raise that's around cost of living, that you need to pay anything for it, is ridiculous, and that Mulgrew would give into this, and that he would stereotype us as a bunch of old codgers, you know, playing shuffleboard or going on vacation or doing something like that. I really believe they saw us as a bunch of passive, no resistance, weak people, and we are not. And we stood up, and we will continue to stand up, and we will continue to do everything within our power. We support the group of NYC retirees led by Marianne Pizzitola. She is a union hero. And during this campaign,
the union... And she comes from a different union, from, like, she was an emergency responder, right?
Correct. That's correct.
And she comes out of that background.
Yep. She came out of nowhere, and she is a force of nature, and I'm so grateful for her.
Mm. And so this is something that the resistance and the opposition extends well beyond the UFT retirees.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The anger is everywhere. The MLC sold us out. They sold us out. And in fact, they have a deal to make a program for in-service people that will cost the mayor 10% less than what he's paying now. So we have the spectacle of union leaders working for Eric Adams. You know, when I was a chapter leader at Francis Lewis High School, the worst thing you could say about the chapter leader is he's in bed with the principal, you know? And I would say the worst thing you could say about a union leader is that he's in bed with the mayor. And that's where Michael Mulgrew has been.
Yeah, and just to clarify here, when we talk about the MLC, we're talking about the Municipal Labor Committee, which is sort of maybe the steering committee, if you want to call it, for different union leaders, and they negotiate with the mayor and city hall, and then sort of bring back these concessions and,
you know, another thing,
impose them on their rank and file.
Another thing Randy Weingarten told us today was that she didn't want agreements made in which we had no input. And the fact is, the MLC made this agreement without any input. The MLC is dominated by the UFT and by DC 37, and they alone control enough votes to do whatever they want. And there were many unions that did not want to go along with this, and because they have fewer members, they just got dragged into this.
Right. I know one union that I'm familiar with that was very opposed to this was the Professional Staff Congress, which represents about 30,000 workers at the City University of New York.
Yep.
But dwarfed in size by these bigger unions.
They, in fact, put out an information sheet about what rank and file could look forward to when this agreement by the MLC comes forth. Rank and file will find that they have a tiered system where you can go to this place and it won't cost much, you can go to that place and it'll cost more, and you can go to this place and it will cost a lot.
Yeah, did I understand you correctly when you were saying, I mean, they've not only tried to impose this on the retirees, though so far they've been thwarted in court repeatedly, but that they're starting to come up with ideas for imposing this sort of thing on active union members too. What starts with the retirees is not necessarily going to stop with the retirees.
Yeah, they're degrading the health care of rank and file. I think rank and file has not jumped up and been as awakened as we have, but I think that's coming, and I think they know that's coming, and that's why they haven't announced exactly what this plan is. I mean, they tell us it'll be as good or better than what we currently have, but they said the same thing about the Medicare scheme, and that's been proven untrue again and again in court, and we can no longer believe them. You know, the UFT is a big union, it is a great union, and the UFT needs to be an activist union, and the UFT needs to be a democratic union, and that's what we, retiree advocate, will fight for. I'm so proud to be part of this movement, and I'm so amazed to be part of this movement, because I put off retirement for 2 years because I couldn't imagine not being an activist, not being part of this thing of ours, and yet, when I did retire, it turned out that retirees were leading the movement. We are the leaders of the movement, and we are retired teachers, and we are going to teach rank and file what they need to do.
Right. So let's talk about this a little bit more, how you all won this election, because, I mean, we're talking about, I think you all got 17,000 votes, more or less, and the incumbent faction got about 10,000. So you all really out-hustled the incumbents here. What all went into this effort?
I think people were educated about Medicare Advantage. People understood what it meant. People saw through the lies we were fed by leadership. And it was interesting to me because when this first started, it was going to be Emblem, which is also GHI, which I had through my cancer. And I didn't feel in the beginning that it would be such a bad thing because they treated me pretty well. Then it went to Aetna, which used to have run slave insurance, for God's sake. And Aetna has a reputation. I have friends in near Chicago who are in Aetna plans who speak of it, you know, with horror. And I don't believe Michael Mulgrew when he says, oh, we're going to have a special committee that will review when you're rejected. But, you know, they review when you're rejected. You could still be rejected. We need real Medicare. And the city promised us that. When I became a teacher, my father said to me, well, you'll never make much money, but when you retire, you'll have a really good retirement, and the city will really take care of you. And, you know, they tried to prove my father wrong. And
you said you taught for 39 years.
I did. I taught in New York City for 39 years. I was an ESL teacher. I taught mostly at Francis Lewis High School. Great school. I love teaching there. Right now, I'm an F status teacher. I'm there 2 days a week. I have a great boss. I know a lot of teachers do not, but I do. I have the best boss in New York City. And I'm really happy to go back there. I hope to go back there next year, too.
Right. Well, we want to keep you in good health so you can keep on going back.
Thank you.
Now, just to talk a little bit more about the workings of your union, the UFT was founded in 1960, and pretty much since its inception, it's been controlled by the same caucus. It goes by the name of the Unity Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just elaborate a little bit more how they've managed to maintain their power, sort of the different levers that they wield?
Well, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the main lever they wield is patronage. And I want to speak a little bit about the paraprofessionals.
What is a paraprofessional?
A paraprofessional is someone who helps children in a classroom. Paraprofessionals, in an eight-period day, when I might teach five periods and prep or do other things, other periods, paraprofessional works seven periods, gets one period off for lunch, and sometimes we have to battle for that. And paraprofessionals work really hard. I've watched them. As a long-standing teacher, I don't think I could do what they do, and they do it for very low pay.
Okay.
And one thing that happened, a couple of things that happened that I found despicable was the way they treated these paraprofessionals. My friend Migdo Rodriguez was elected second vice chair of the paraprofessionals a few years back. UFT Unity did not give her a job. They did not give her an office. They did not give her time to do work. They did not even give her a UFT email. They gave her nothing. And the person who was second vice chair before her got to keep his union job. And they dispense these union jobs as patronage. And they give them out.
And patronage in return for loyalty?
Loyalty. And we have people who are hired for loyalty as opposed to talent. And, you know, as chapter leader, I used to have to tell people, when you call the UFT, if you get somebody good, great. If you don't, get back to me, and I will find you somebody good. And the way I found good people were through contacts. And my best contact was Amy Arundel, who she worked running the Queen's office. Really, really smart woman. And if my members didn't find somebody good, Amy said, use this person, use that person. And she would go out of her way to help. She would go out of her way to help anybody, even when we're on opposite sides of the fence, when I'm opposition and she's unity.
Something has happened to her because...
Yes. She was removed as Queen's leader, and she was replaced by somebody who was more loyal to Michael Mulgrew, who, you know, sits in his office and does whatever. And that's a disgrace. And another member of my caucus, Jonathan Hallaby, and I, we were walking out of an executive board meeting where Mulgrew had said he had to leave or he had to go somewhere. And we see him walking across Broadway. And Jonathan said to him, you know, Michael, you've hurt the Queen's members. You shouldn't have done that to the Queen's members. And Mulgrew did not even respond to us. He ran across the street like we were not there. That's our union president.
Mm. And so next year there will be union-wide elections for president and all the other top leadership positions. Do you think this revolt that has started within the retiree chapter is something that will spread and potentially affect the larger union?
Yes, I do. I think we're going to take the union back. We're going to make the United Federation of Teachers a democracy. We're going to make the United Federation of Teachers an activist union. No longer will it be that when you have a problem in the school, you hope, oh, Michael Mulgrew, come on your white horse and save us. You know, union leaders are not mommy and daddy. Union leaders are just that, leaders. But we need activism in our union. We need action in our union. We need people who are not afraid. I used to be afraid as a teacher. I had a blog and I didn't put my name on it. At some point, I just stopped being afraid, and it was liberating, and I would love to share that with my brothers and sisters. When I was chapter leader, I don't remember, I filed a grievance or something, and some guy said to me, well, you could do that because you're you, but I have no superpower. I'm just not afraid. And we don't need to be afraid. There are many of us, and our power is in numbers, and we need to stand up, and we will stand up, and we will have a democratic United Federation of Teachers beginning next year.
And that, so you heard it here first. The revolution will be spreading through the rank and file of the largest union local in the city, and that could have potentially big consequences. I mean, if the UFT was a more dynamic union, it could create ripples throughout.
That's what union is for. That's what union does. Union gets something, and then everybody else gets it. And we have a union that's moving backwards. Today, Randy Weingarten
is the former leader of the UFT and now the leader of the national union.
Randy Weingarten is super smart. She is eloquent. She speaks off the top of her head. She is a brilliant woman. I really have to give her props for that. I'm not used to hearing union leadership that is so smart, and I respect her intelligence, and I admire her intelligence. But despite that, today she told us, here's what we're going to do. We're going to lobby nationally that nobody should lose their health care. And that is great. That is admirable. I'm glad. But if Randy Weingarten wants to help us now, the fact is we have bills before the city council. We have bills before the state assembly and legislature, and we want the state assembly and Senate, rather, and we want those bills passed. It's my understanding that between the assembly and the Senate, there are enough votes to pass our bill, but that unions, meaning union bosses, stop these bills from being voted upon.
Yeah, let's talk about this. I think we're here in New York. We're talking about the New York Health Act, which would create a universal
That's another thing. That is not what I was talking about. Okay. I was talking about a bill to protect our Medicare. But but since you brought up the New York Health Act, I absolutely support the New York Health Act. It would support. It would solve a lot of problems. And there are some problems with it. But the sponsors have said they'd be willing to negotiate. Now, Michael Mulgrew says he opposes it. But Michael Mulgrew also says that the UFT Delegate Assembly is the most powerful rulemaking body of the United Federation of Teachers. Well, the UFT Delegate Assembly voted to support the New York Health Act, not once, but twice. And Mulgrew has unilaterally decided to oppose it.
Right. And as I understand it, the reason some union leaders like Michael Mulgrew at the UFT do this is when you have a union-negotiated health care coverage, it makes the union leaders who negotiate those coverages seem more important to their members. They're delivering the goods. And a universal health care coverage for all New Yorkers would sort of end the specialness of what these union leaders are doing. Of course, if they didn't have to fight over health care, they could go win other advances for their workers, but they're kind of stuck in that mode right
well,
now.
Well, it's not just about how special it is. It's about the patronage. It's about how many jobs there are. We've put forward, the New York City retirees, have put forward proposals to save some of the money. Michael Mulgrew agreed to save for a three-year contract. He agreed to save $600 million a year forever. And one way he could do that would be by consolidating all the welfare funds in the city. Instead of a UFT welfare fund and a welfare fund for every other union, we could have one central welfare fund. That would save a lot of money. And he doesn't want to do that because he doesn't want to give up the patronage. This is what keeps his caucus humming, all these jobs. And these jobs, frankly, should go to the people who the union elected, not to people who are willing to kiss Michael Mulgrew's ring.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. All right. We'll have to leave it there. But real quickly, for any of our listeners who want to find out more about Retirees Advocate, who may be retired teachers or other retired city workers, where can they find out more about you guys?
Well, we do have a webpage. You could search for it might be retireeadvocate.org. I'm not actually sure, but you could do a Google search. And we're also on Facebook. And I have a Substack called Union Matters. I should plug my own Substack
while
I'm here.
We're all about independent media here. So we'll have to wrap it up. But Arthur Goldstein, newly elected vice chair of the UFT Retirees chapter, and a longtime public school teacher here in New York. Thank you so much for joining us on WBAI 99.5 FM today.
Thank you, John.
Okay. All right, we'll be back with more after this short break.
الصبور إن حاولوا عصرها.
That was Three Anid Ana by the El Fajer Group. You're listening to the Independent News Hour on 99.5 FM, your community radio station right here on the middle of the FM dial in New York. We're excited to go to our next guest, Claire Valdez, in a moment. But first, I just want to encourage everybody who can do so to help keep this radio station humming along, help keep it on the air. Call 212-209-2950 or go to givenumber2wbai.org. Whether you can make a one-time annual contribution or become a sustaining member, a WBAI buddy for $10 a month or more, we so appreciate your help. You want to give in the name of the Independent News Hour if you value this show every week. We certainly appreciate that. The most important thing is to support this station. We don't have deep-pocketed corporate sponsors or billionaire backers or any of that. We count on listeners like yourself. You know, the old saying, from each according to their ability and to each according to their need. If you have a little bit of extra money, this station plays such a unique role here in New York City. Please give it your support. 212-209-2950. I do a lot of the fundraising work for the Independent along with other responsibilities. And, we certainly value every contribution we get. Each contribution makes a huge difference. And it's the same thing here at WBAI. It really is a people-powered radio station. 212-209-2950. And you can also go online. You can pull out the plastic at givenumber2wbai.org. So I'll share that info one more time at the end of the show. But please be ready to support WBAI today. And we're going to move on to the second half of our show and our next guest. 1 week from today, June 25th, is primary day here in New York. Voters will be going to the polls in Republican and Democratic primaries. Of course, New York City is overwhelmingly a Democratic city. A lot of elections, a lot of elected offices are really determined in the primaries. And there's a number of competitive races. Also, early voting began on Saturday and will continue through this weekend. And we have a number of races where left-wing progressive candidates, socialist candidates, are challenging entrenched, more corporate Democratic incumbents. We also have the race up in Westchester County in the Northern Bronx, where Jamal Bowman is being challenged by an AIPAC-backed politician up there, George Latimer. But we also have several state legislative races where insurgent challengers are taking on entrenched incumbents and trying to win seats. And one of those races is out in Western Queens, in Assembly District 37, where DSA-backed union organizer Clara Valdez is running for office for the first time and has garnered dozens of endorsements from community organizations, labor unions, and others, and is running against opposition that is backed by AIPAC-type groups and charter school funds and all the rest. And we're really excited to have Claire join us today. Claire, welcome to WBAI.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Uh, One moment. I just want to make...
Turn up your volume. The volume. On your headphones. Your headphones.
Sorry. So we're just having a technical glitch here. But one moment.
Can you hear?
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, Claire. Sorry about that. So,
okay.
So let's talk, just start, if you want to say a little bit more about yourself and how you made your way from Lubbock, Texas, where you grew up, to New York, and what brought you into the union movement.
Yeah, so I moved to New York in 2015. I moved here to work, like so many other New Yorkers, came to New York City for a better life. And so I've been working in the arts for a long time and decided that I wanted to transition and work at Columbia University. Little did I know at the time that it was going to be a union job. So I joined UIW Local 2110 in 2018. And, you know, after years of working part-time jobs, minimum wage, hours and hours of unpaid overtime, my union just changed my life. You know, I won immediately kind of better benefits, better pay, and a seat at the table so I could stand in solidarity with 500 of my coworkers. We're a union that represents support staff on Columbia University's campus. So that's clerical workers like myself and also cashiers, call center workers, primarily women of color who helped organize this union in the mid-80s to fight for pay parity and against, you know, really racist policies at Columbia. And yeah, my union changed my life. I never expected to kind of go into politics, but what I saw in my own union and in, you know, the recent years of UAW becoming this, you know, really reformed union, a real fighting union for working class people across the country. What I saw is that when we organize together, we can win the things that we deserve. We can win fully funded public schools and a reliable MTA and social housing for everyone. And so my union really inspired me to run for office, and that's, I guess, the short story of how I ended up in this position.
And how did you become a socialist? Why did you make that step?
I feel like my union was a big part of that, too. So I joined my union in 2018, and then shortly thereafter joined DSA. And I know this is kind of a dull point, but one of the big things my union gave me was just free time, the time to kind of become a political person, to step away from my, you know, my job and my desk at 5 o'clock. And so many working people are crushed by multiple jobs, by all kinds of obligations just to get by. And having a union job gave me the kind of security that I needed to organize in my union, but also get politically active outside of it. And socialists have a long history organizing in unions and organizing working class people. So the connection was really clear after I joined my union and saw what organization can do for a working person. And I joined DSA not super long after that. But I was also really inspired by, you know, Julia Salazar's run in 2018 and AOC winning in 2018. Just that a work, like everyday normal people can mount these campaigns and can run them and win them and defeat, you know, Democratic establishment old guard was incredibly inspiring to see too.
Indeed. And now you're running for state assembly on a message of workers deserve it all. Can you talk about that a little bit more, why you've made that sort of a mantra for your campaign?
Yeah, totally. Because it's true. workers do deserve it all. We deserve a city that and state that really works for us. For so long, you know, working people have been immiserated, pushed to the margins, made, you know, housing insecure, food insecure. And it's really because a really small owning class wants to know to buy another boat, to buy another house. And working people deserve basic dignity. We deserve to be able to survive in the city, to thrive in the city, to raise our children in our neighborhoods, to have excellent mass transit and excellent public schools and so much more. And I really believe that in, you know, one of the richest cities in the richest country that this world has ever seen, we have the resource to make all of that possible. Yeah. We just need to organize.
Yeah, I want to talk about that more in a couple of minutes, but just to follow up on your involvement as a labor organizer, you know, it's it's not unheard of for union members to run for office, but it's not that common either. And I was thinking about how a couple of years ago, when the taxi drivers were the indebted taxi drivers were doing their hunger strike in Zoran Mamdani, an assembly member who's also a member of DSA, joined that hunger strike and became a part of that pressure campaign that ultimately forced Mayor de Blasio to negotiate a debt reduction for those thousands of cab drivers. I remember seeing an anonymous quote in a paper from another elected official who was sort of horrified that an elected official had not just come out and offered words of support for those workers, but had kind of thrown themselves full force into leveraging whatever power they had to help those workers, and had essentially taken sides in a struggle between labor and business, and how improper they thought that was. Your thoughts? Is it okay for an elected official to be decisively on one side or another?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what solidarity is. Solidarity is standing with people who are up against, forces that are telling them that they don't deserve debt relief. They don't deserve to have stable employment or be able to send their kids to college. You know, solidarity is being able to stand with those people and say, I'm on your side, and I will provide whatever resources as I can, whatever leverage I have, whatever power I can to help you win this fight. Because, in labor, we say a lot, an injury to one is an injury to all. And it's because we know that our fates are tied up with each other's, and that, working people struggle all the time. And the choice isn't whether or not to struggle. It's whether we struggle together or we struggle alone. And so I was really inspired by that hunger strike, by all the taxi workers who really put themselves on the line to win what they deserved. And I think Assemblymember Mamdani is a real tribute to this movement by standing with them.
Yes. And speaking of people standing together, last night the Rent Guidelines Board met and approved rent increases for New York's 950,000 rent-stabilized tenants. It would be a 2.75% rent increase for one-year lease renewals and 5.5% for two-year lease renewals. There are hundreds of tenants protesting outside where the meeting was held at Hunter College on the Upper East Side, and a number of people were arrested, including Assemblymember Mamdani, as well as Assemblymember Marcela Montañez from Sunset Park, and City Council Member Alexa Aviles, also from Sunset Park. And we're going to just listen here a little bit to some of the protesters. So those protesters there were chanting, RGB, listen up, we're in struggle. Your thoughts on what happened last night with the rent increases, and also what you want to do as a state legislator in Albany to address the affordable housing crisis here in New York City as well as New York State?
Yeah, I mean, it's really reprehensible that we're imposing rent increases that are rent-stabilized tenants at a time when housing prices are through the roof. The cost of housing is really untenable for most working people. And we're facing, a really historic affordability crisis in the city kind of across the board. This is obviously Eric Adams' Rent Guidelines Board. We know who to blame in this scenario, and it's absolutely the mayor. In Albany, we have to fight for stronger tenant protections. We have to fight for the original version of Good Cause that did not pass in this last session. The version that passed cut out far too many tenants, cut too many people out of having the protections that they deserve to have. And so really strong tenant protections, expanding rent stabilization, are some of the first things I want to fight for. There's also a piece of legislation called, introduced by Assemblymember Gallagher, that would create a social housing development authority. And I'm really excited about this. the statewide authority that would create social housing across the entire state.
And what is social housing?
Yeah, so social housing is a model of housing that has kind of three basic tenets: deep and permanent affordability, democratic management by the people who live in it, and that's insulated from market forces. And that provides tenants with stable long-term housing that they can actually obviously afford, and that's created by the state. And so we don't have to look to the real estate development industry to, you know, throw us a few crumbs every now and then, 20% affordable units in massive luxury developments. We can have our state take this challenge on directly and be real, have a democratic way out of this housing crisis. And that's really exciting because the real estate industry has sold tenants out for decades and decades, and has made billions of dollars off of our need for stable housing. So that's one way to think about how we get out of this housing crisis, how we create more social housing, how we help tenants who want to buy their building from their landlord. If their landlord wants to sell it, there's a piece of legislation called TOPA, the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act. There's a lot of ways we can think about solving this problem. And yeah, I'm excited to fight for those things.
And just to talk a little bit more about social housing, like what would be the closest past examples of that kind of program, and how does what you have in mind, say, compared to the public housing system we currently have here in New York with NYCHA, as well as the Mitchell-Lama program of the past that subsidized affordable housing for a generation of New Yorkers?
Yeah, so we can look to Mitchell-Lama and, for example, Co-op City in the Bronx is good examples that kind of approximate this program. What's important about the Social Housing Development Authority is that it would be statewide and state-run, so we wouldn't have to, you know, look to federal funding for this. It could be all within New York State, and yeah, help empower tenants to control their housing, help empower the state to create more housing. I think that's really a really exciting way to think about it.
And so talking about sort of having a bigger vision, yesterday there was a fascinating exchange on WNYC between Brian Lehr and Jamal Bowman, who's a DSA endorsed for Congress, about whether elected officials should really be talking about aspirational visionary agendas, or if they should just stick to talking about sort of very smaller scale initiatives. And this is what Bowman had to say, and I'd be curious to get your reaction afterwards.
I am a passionate person. I want everyone in the world to be passionate about something, especially when it's rooted in justice. I'm passionate about making sure every child on our planet has access to clean water and healthy foods and healthcare and a safe place to live. I'm passionate about making sure we end the scourge of gun violence in our country. I'm passionate to make sure our seniors have dental and optical and hearing as part of a healthcare package. I'm passionate about that. And all of this unrealistic stuff, why, whenever we're talking about working class people, poor people, and black and brown people, the policies are so unrealistic? But when we're talking about $600 billion in tax cuts for corporations, it's not unrealistic. Or when we're talking about the trillions in Trump tax cuts that my opponent supports, it's not unrealistic. Look at the history of America, right? If we don't have vision and aspiration, we don't have a country. And so we want America to be the best version of itself. And in order to do that, we need everyone, all Americans at the table, to be a part of the conversation. And we need to be aspirational for them, the working class, the poor, people of color, and those who feel powerless within our system. Let's be aspirational for them. Let's have a vision for them, Brian. And then we can become the country we are capable of being.
All right. So again, that was Congressman Jamal Bowman speaking yesterday with Brian Lehr. He's in a very hard-fought primary in Northern Bronx and Westchester County that will also be determined next Tuesday, facing $20 million in attacks from AIPAC-backed groups. And also there's going to be a big rally with Bowman, AOC, and Bernie Sanders at St. Mary's Park in South Bronx on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. And also Bernie and Jamal Bowman will be doing a rally in Hastings on the Hudson at McEacheron Park on Friday afternoon. But Claire, your reaction to the defense of a visionary politics?
I mean, yeah, my reaction is hell yeah. It's true. We need people who have a vision for a better world. We need people who can imagine that we can afford, you know, universal health care, that we can have universal child care, that we can have free public transit. All of these things are possible. My union is a big part of why I'm running for office. And I think a lot about, you know, how unions built New York City, how unions built the housing system, the, you know, healthcare system, all these things from scratch. And that's just everyday working people. And for generations and generations, working families have been pushed out of the political process because big real estate, Wall Street, hedge fund managers, venture capitalists have poured money into our races and prevented grassroots efforts and grassroots candidates from being successful. And I think what we're seeing now is a movement where that's being rejected whole cloth by working families in our communities. We can imagine a vision of politics where everyone has a seat at the table. The really transformative thing about being in my union was that I was able to, you know, bargain for my next contract. As a member of a bargaining committee, I got to sit across the table from management. And in that scenario, legally, you're equal to management. But what I learned sitting there with my coworkers by my side and like organizing for what we deserved, what I found out is that you're actually so much more powerful than your boss when you're in a union, when you're standing shoulder to shoulder and you're demanding the things that you deserve. And so having a seat at the table, making everyday people feel like they're politically powerful, you know, that's not a radical thing by any means, but it's exactly how we change the political status quo in New York State and New York City. And we need people who are willing to really commit to that and to fight for that. Because that's how we get out of these crises. This is how we get out of the housing crisis. This is how we get out of the climate crisis. We need visionary people who are ready to dream big and to fight really hard for those things.
Right. And your organization, the Democratic Socialists of America, has elected 8 people to the state legislature since 2018, has also helped elect AOC and Jamal Bowman to Congress and a couple other people to city council. What do you think the impact has been so far of having 8 socialists in the New York State Legislature? And what do you think the impact would be if you and the other insurgent candidates, Jonathan Soto and Ian Huntley in Bed-Stuy, if y'all make it to the state legislature and if there's as many as 11 socialists in the state legislature, how significant would that be?
Yeah, I mean, when we first elected Julia Salazar in 2018, you know, she was instrumental in passing HSTPA in 2019. We saw
what is HSTPA?
The housing Housing Stability Internet Protection Act. I was getting this up, but really important rent or tenant protections that covered a lot of New Yorkers, and that was really incredible legislation that Julia Salazar really drove. Last year, we saw Build Public Renewables Act pass, and that was, you know, a lot of that was because socialists in office organized for that. Sarah Hanna Shrestha organized for that. We had fighters and climate champions in Albany who were ready to go to bat and pass, you know, landmark Green New Deal legislation for New York State. And so we can see that even adding a couple of people to this block of socialists in office can be transformative. Even adding just a couple of people who are going to be force multipliers in Albany and really fight for the things, the transformative legislation that we really need and deserve in New York City and New York State, it would be huge. It would be a game changer. If we can win all 3 races, if we can change this from 8 socialists in office to 11, that's a really big deal. And we can start to imagine, you know, passing things like the New York Health Act, passing things like universal child care. And that's a really exciting thing to think about.
Okay. And real quickly before we have to go, 30 seconds, your thoughts on the governor canceling congestion pricing?
Oh, my gosh. Just, in you know, a real slap in the face to the millions of people who rely on public transit. We already had all this, all these capital projects earmarked and ready to go, elevators at stations that desperately need them, switch upgrades, so many things. It's a real political betrayal to working class people who rely on the subway, who need clean air to breathe. It's really, a huge disappointment. And again, we need leaders who are going to stand up to the governor when she makes these, you know, unilateral and undemocratic decisions that impact our working families.
And where can people find out more about your campaign and where you will be campaigning in this last week of 15 seconds?
Yeah, ClaireForQueens.com. Sign up for a shift. We're doing more canvassing. I'm about to head out to a canvas right now. Poll site visibility. There's lots of ways to plug in this final stretch, but it's that volunteer energy that's going to help us win.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. Claire Valdez, candidate for Assembly District 37 in Western Queens, thank you so much for joining us on WBAI. And we're going to leave now. Thank you to our board operator, Reggie Johnson, also to Amber Gagarian and Ariana Roscoe for their help with this show. And we're leaving with Que Vamos a Hacer.
Good evening. I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. President Joe Biden marked the 12th anniversary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, at the White House on Tuesday. He detailed a new plan to allow thousands of undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens to apply for legal residency while remaining in the United States.
For those wives or husbands and their children who have lived in America for a decade or more but are undocumented, this action will allow them to file the paperwork for legal status in the United States, allow them to work while they remain with their families in the United States.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asserted Tuesday that Secretary of State Antony Blinken has assured him all restrictions on weapon transfers to Israel will be lifted in coming days. Later, Blinken said Netanyahu had exaggerated the steps being taken by the U.S. A shipment of 2,000-pound bombs has been paused, but it's unclear if other bombs are being sent to make up the difference. Pentagon spokesperson General Pat Ryder.
We've paused one shipment of high payload unguided munitions. There's not been a final determination at this time on how to proceed with that shipment. As you've heard us say previously, there are concerns about the use of these munitions in a dense urban setting like Rafah.
Israel and Lebanon have been escalating rhetoric as the United States envoy has been trying to keep a new war from igniting on Israel's northern border. The Lebanese group Hezbollah fired hundreds of missiles into Israel after one of its top leaders was killed in an attack earlier this month. Hezbollah has hinted it may attack Haifa, one of Israel's largest cities, if Israel responds. Israel says it's prepared an operational plan for an offensive against Lebanon. Journalist Richard Silverstein spoke with WBAI on Tuesday.
Hezbollah is much, much more capable of inflicting damage on Israel than Hamas. It has advanced weapons Iran has transferred to Lebanon. It has several hundred thousand missiles. These are precise missiles and quite advanced.
Silverstein adds Hezbollah has already destroyed several high-value targets in Israel, and a war is yet to start.
Yesterday, a military factory in northern Israel was targeted and hit by a Hezbollah anti-tank missile. A week or two ago, Hezbollah actually destroyed a Patriot missile battery in northern Israel.
In recent days, the moderate wing of Israel's war cabinet resigned over their differences with Netanyahu and his far-right supporters.
He now has to rely on them much more closely than he did before. That means that the government will be shifting even more to the right than it is right now, and it's now committing genocide, so you can imagine what that means.
After Hezbollah's attack on Israel, the United Nations warned of a possible miscalculation, plunging the region into another war. And in local news, New York City long ago banned wearing masks because of protesters and in some cases bandits hiding their identity from police. But when COVID hit in 2020, the state's mask laws were overturned and replaced with mandates to wear masks on subways, buses, and other public places. Governor Kathy Hochul recently called for re-prohibiting those masks on the subway. On Tuesday, Mayor Eric Adams chimed in.
Covering your face while you do terrible things is not new. There were these guys that used to ride around with hoods. cowards in the Deep South. Cowards cover their faces. But standing on our trains, telling people if you're Zionist, raise your hand and get off. Show your face and say that. So I believe the governor's in the right place, and I strongly support it.
And the heat is on. New York City is under a heat advisory as temperatures hit the upper 80s Tuesday, with a lot more heat expected. The city could see 100 degrees by the weekend, when the heat will dissipate a little. Although swimming pools are the traditional way to beat the heat in New York, those won't be open until the end of the month. Deputy Mayor Meera Joshi.